Though he had his doubts, seeing Street across the house chamber, he had an idea.
"I could use your help on something, yes," Charlie said. "There's a chemical plant for which General Kinetics is trying to get a permit in Harlem. A lot of local civil rights activists are after me to block it. Total headache. If you could kill it and handle Congressman Powell, that would be extremely helpful. I could try, but it would be nasty for me to get involved in any way since Powell supports it."
"Why don't you want it?" Carlin asked.
"Actually, never mind. That's your business. Let me see what I can do."
Carlin lifted himself up off the chair, nodded to Charlie, and walked away. The Pennsylvania Railroad's afternoon congressional train departed D.C.'s Union Station at 4:30 p.m. sharp each weekday and made the 227-mile journey north to New York City's Penn Station in 3 hours and 35 minutes. Following the vote to provide military aid to the U.K. for its crackdown against Malayan guerrillas, Charlie walked the mile from the Capitol to Union Station and bought a ticket, and he still had time for a shoeshine before he boarded the train to Manhattan. He had no overnight bag, hadn't told his office where he was going, and had no way to leave a note for Margaret in case she came home and wondered where he was. In fact, he thought grimly as he sat waiting for his shoeshine, there was part of him that hoped that would happen, that wanted her to worry about him and even mildly panic. "Why should I be the only one uneasy?" he thought, disgusted with his marching orders from McCarthy and even more sickened by the fact that he was going to carry them out. He felt ill. His stomach churned, and the anxiety and loneliness he'd been trying to keep at bay began falling upon him like a dark cloak. "Get it together," he said to himself. "Take control." He stood and walked to his gate, showed his ticket, boarded, walked through the stainless steel cars, coach, dining, observation car. He found a seat in the parlor car just as the locomotive jerked forward and the train began slowly chugging north on its journey, through the ghettos of Northeast Washington, past the Columbia Institution for the Instruction of the Deaf and Dumb on the right, and the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception and Catholic University on the left. He picked up the afternoon star from the empty seat beside him. The U.S. government had rounded up 91 Puerto Ricans in New York City and brought them to the Foley Square Courthouse, part of the investigation into the Capitol Hill shooting the previous week. The RNC had decided that Vice President Nixon would be better suited to respond to Adlai Stevenson than Senator McCarthy would. Once again, he could find nothing about the car crash. As the train crossed the border into Maryland, Charlie caught himself feeling as if he'd managed to escape from behind enemy lines, though he knew, of course, he had freed himself from precisely nothing. Chapter 18. Monday, March 8th, 1954, afternoon. On the train from Washington, D.C. to New York City.
"You look lost in thought," came a maternal voice as Charlie sat down in the club car of the train.
Charlie turned around to see Senator Margaret Chase Smith standing at the tiny bar, holding a glass of ginger ale. He smiled.
"Hello, Senator. Wasn't expecting to see you here."
"Oh, I love the train. I take it all the way up to Boston, then drive to Portland."
She raised her glass and took a sip. Charlie was too distracted to come up with any suitable small talk. Smith, the practiced politician, filled the silence easily as he made room for her to join him in the seat next to his.
"You know, I have been meaning to tell you after we had lunch. I read your book. It was marvelous. I found the section on Benjamin Franklin at the Hellfire Club especially fascinating. I wanted to know more."
Charlie caught the bartender's eye and ordered a beer.
"I did too, but that's all I could find," Charlie said. "And even that was pretty controversial. I received letters from a number of DAR and historical societies in Pennsylvania who were not happy to hear about old Ben's secret life."
"Why, if they knew anything at all about him, they must have known he was a libertine."
"One would think," Charlie said.
"You know what I wondered about Franklin's time at the Hellfire Club?"
Charlie raised an encouraging eyebrow.
"Well, he seemed to think it quite useful. All these powerful men in one wanton association where they could do business and engage in revelry and whatnot."
"Especially the whatnot," Charlie smiled. "But yes, they did a lot of business there, as you know."
"Indeed," she grinned. "So, did he attempt to recreate anything like it upon returning to the colonies?"
Charlie rubbed his chin. "There was nothing about that in the diaries and nothing in the Franklin papers at Yale." The train gave a bit of a jump, causing both Smith and Charlie to lurch forward. Smith spilled some of her ginger ale on the floor.
"Oh, dear," she said. You okay?
Fine, dear boy, fine.
She looked around the car, seeming to make sure nobody was listening to their conversation.
Do you know about the members-only collection at the Library of Congress?
I heard about it from, the late Congressman McLachlan, he said. Should I pay it a visit?
Oh, I think you'd find it of great interest.
She gave Charlie a look that he found hard to read.
A collection of papers and books only accessible to members of the House and Senate. It's in a special room in the Adams Building of the library. You should check it out, see if there's more on Franklin there. I myself would love a sequel to your book, as I suspect would many of your fans.
She patted his arm, encouragingly or condescendingly. Charlie again couldn't quite tell.
The Hellfire Club, she remarked almost to herself. Seems like a secret society like that one, replicated in modern times, could be very influential. Theoretically.
Charlie looked at her, but trying to read her face was like trying to read Esperanto. I'm sure you're more than aware that there are any number of secret societies throughout Washington, she added.
Skull and Bones, Sons of Liberty, the Patriotic Order, the Elks, the Klan.
One hears whispers about them, but of course nothing concrete. Washington makes much more sense once you realize that there are factions that people like you and me know nothing about.
People like you and me?
Moral people, she said.
Good people. And people who are outsiders to a degree.
Well, I don't know that I belong in your esteemed company, Charlie said. That was a brave thing you did, coming out against McCarthy back in, when was it, 1950? And it's been pretty dispiriting to see so many of our fellow Republicans sit back and let this indecency continue.
She blushed. Why, thank you, Charlie.
No, I mean it, he said. I don't think I understood until recently how tough it is to stand up for what's right in politics. It all looks so easy from the outside, but inside, the imperatives, the forces, the motivations almost always push one toward complicity or silence, if not worse. The system seems designed to grind away our better natures.
Smith took a second, apparently to contemplate what Charlie was saying and decide how to properly respond. It has been incredibly disappointing, yes, to see otherwise good and decent men think they can straddle the worlds of decent and indecent, she finally said. Senator Taft thought he could do that. He could not. One cannot. One must make a choice. Taft thought he could avoid having to condemn that which he knew was wrong. And then he died, and his cowardice is now regrettably part of his legacy. McCarthy isn't just a demagogue and a serial prevaricator. He's a phony. He won his first election against La Follette by winking toward the communists of Wisconsin, saying nice things about Stalin. None of it means anything to him. It's all just about power and ego. I mean, it often is. That's not unique to Senator McCarthy, but he's a fraud. I feel bad for those whom he is so sadistically fooling.
Charlie's eyes flickered with a memory. Kefauver told me something about McCarthy siding with Nazis once, against U.S. interrogators.
Oh, yes, said Smith. This was before he took up the cause of demonizing the State Department. He was still, I believe, looking for an issue to make him famous. He took over a committee hearing he wasn't even a member of, vilifying the U.S. interrogators as anti-German. Didn't get much press here, but in occupied Germany it was huge. I think McCarthy was even getting information for his smears from communists in Germany at the time. He left an envelope from a Red behind in committee once, as I recall. Just unbelievable. And none of it was true. Ray Baldwin was the chairman of the committee, and McCarthy attacked him too, accused him of trying to whitewash U.S. war crimes. Baldwin resigned. He was so exhausted and demoralized. He was a good man, served in the Navy in World War I, a judge, good Republican, but our leaders just sat back and watched it all happen.
Good Lord, Charlie said.
There's a lesson there, of course, Smith said. When a rat pokes his head up from the sewer, he needs to be hit on the head with a shovel immediately. You cannot just sit back and think, well, it's just one rat, or that's somebody else's problem, because it's never just one rat, and it eventually becomes your problem.
And with that, she patted Charlie on the arm again.
Well, I'll go back to my seat now. Lovely to run into you, Charlie.
With a wave of her hand, the senator nodded goodbye to Charlie, and he watched as she slowly, steadily, made her way to the rear of the train. A train delay in Wilmington, Delaware, in a midtown Manhattan traffic jam prevented Charlie from ringing his parents' doorbell until just after 10 p.m. Standing at the top of the front stoop, he could hear his father stumbling down the brownstone stairs before the door swung open to reveal the man himself. He met his son with a scowl and a powerful aromatic punch of scotch.
"Your mother's asleep," he snarled by way of greeting.
Charlie knew well this side of his father. Three sheets to the wind, obviously had a bad day at work, but wouldn't want to talk about it. Tired, surly.
"You could have called first."
Winston Martyr's paternal instincts were strong enough for him to reach for Charlie's briefcase and carry it up to the living room on the second floor, where a television set provided the only illumination.
"Murrow's going after McCarthy," his father said.
Charlie sat on the couch, and together the two watched as Murrow, in his calm and careful way, eviscerated the Wisconsin Republican, destroying his lies one by one, from the relatively inconsequential ones to a blatantly misleading claim McCarthy had made about Adlai Stevenson toward the end of the 1952 presidential campaign.
"This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve," Murrow intoned at the end of the broadcast. "The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay among our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves."
Murrow ended the broadcast with his signature, "Good night, and good luck." Winston Martyr emitted a sound that was something between a snore and a scoff. Charlie looked at him, surprised, having been impressed by Murrow's monologue, though he did wonder what had taken the journalist so long. Plenty of his peers had been going after McCarthy for years. Muckraking columnist Drew Pearson had been such a persistent critic, rumor had it, that McCarthy had once punched him so hard he'd flown into the air. Journalist Jack Anderson had written a scathing investigative biography of McCarthy in 1952. And 1 year later, cartoonist Walt Kelly started mocking the Wisconsin senator in his popular Pogo comic strip, depicting him as a menacing, shotgun-toting bobcat with disdain for social mores and the U.S. Constitution. Still, Charlie knew Murrow's taking such a stand was significant. These words were coming from a dignified journalist on the giant platform he enjoyed, the cautious, highly rated CBS. Everyone has his own timeline for heroism, Charlie supposed. "So?" Charlie asked.
"McCarthy's a drunk, but he's not wrong about everything," said Winston. "Alger Hiss was a spy. The Rosenbergs were spies. There are Soviet spies throughout the government, in the schools, in universities. Yeah, McCarthy's a blowhard and a liar, but isn't the communist menace a bigger deal than whatever nonsense he says at rallies? I guess I just don't see why everyone is giving McCarthy much attention. Just ignore him."
"He's impossible to ignore. He's become this planet blocking the sun. And whatever points he makes that have validity are blotted out by his indecency and his lies and his predilection to smear. On the Hill, he's all they talk about. Kefauver, Margaret Chase Smith."
"Of course, he's embarrassing. But even when Smith gave her big fancy speech attacking McCarthy, she noted the Truman administration had been sitting on their asses and doing nothing while commies began swarming the U.S. like locusts."
He paused and looked more carefully at Charlie.
"Did you not even pack a bag? Just the briefcase?"
"Yeah, this trip is a little spur of the moment." He didn't mention Margaret's current whereabouts, since he knew his folks wouldn't approve. Winston lifted himself out of his chair with a groan and began shuffling toward his study. His earlier irritation at Charlie's surprised late arrival had apparently subsided.
"Come on in for a nightcap if you want."
Winston's study was where he kept his most important documents, as well as a giant floor globe and his collection of 19th-century books, most of them focused on the presidency and assassination of Abraham Lincoln and on the life of Teddy Roosevelt. As his dad occupied himself at the side table where decanters held his scotch and bourbon, Charlie took in the comforting scent of the room, cigar smoke and ancient texts and his dad's musky cologne. When he was a boy, this room had seemed to hold all the secrets of adulthood, serious men in serious trouble, and whispered agreements, and handshakes like vice grips, and the lingering menace of debts owed.
"Estes tells me you seem to be getting along better now," Winston Martyr said,
handing Charlie a tumbler containing two fingers of bourbon and one ice cube. He sank into his chair, a walnut Victorian parlor armchair with intricately carved designs resembling tassels. The 19th century antique creaked beneath his weight, which was increasing around his middle as he approached 60. "I suppose," said Charlie, "that depends on how one defines getting along better. Doing things other people want me to that I'm not particularly proud of? Yes, I'm doing more of that. Passing on files to the McCarthy Committee and participating in the great comic book hearing." Winston Martyr chuckled and Charlie suppressed a sigh of irritation.
"Yes, I suppose that's how I would define it at this stage of your nascent political career. You're not getting anything for yourself?"
"I asked Chairman Carlin if he would block a permit for a chemical plant in Harlem. Negro friend of mine asked me to help him with that." Winston's eyes lit up.
"That was you? I heard about that. Adam Powell is furious. General Kinetics, too. No matter. Now Harley Staggers and Bob Mollahan are fighting over which pocket of Appalachia the plant should move to."
Staggers and Mollahan were West Virginia Democrats, aggressive seekers of the federal dole, and anything else that might improve the plight of their impoverished constituents. Charlie would have liked to bask in his father's approval, but he could only stare grimly into the glass in his hands.
"What's eating you?"
Charlie paused before admitting, "I hadn't really thought about the fact that whatever ill effects come from this chemical plant will now be inflicted on other people." Winston's smile was part amusement, part acknowledgement of the injustice of the world.
"Yep. That's how it works, Charlie."
He yawned, looking like a lion growling. Charlie wished he could be comforted by his father's benevolent world-weariness. Instead, he found himself fighting a mounting sense of frustrated indignation. He needed direction, not aphorisms. "Chairman Carlin wants me to co-sponsor the farm bill with him. He's trying to use me to co-opt the other veterans and any other skeptical Yankees."
"That's good. Nothing wrong with having a record farmers can like. Costs you nothing and could pay off later. How about Estes's latest project, these Nuremberg trials for Bugs Bunny? You set that up for him?"
"Yep. Next month at Foley Square Courthouse."
"Ever the good soldier."
"Yes, sir." Winston stood and stretched his arms as high as they could go and then spread them out as if he were on a crucifix.
"Pooped," he said. "Let's have lunch tomorrow at the club. Noon?"
He patted Charlie's shoulder as he left the room, leaving his son sitting in the dim glow of the lamp that stood next to the wooden file cabinet where the most sensitive files were kept. It was the only cabinet that his father took the time to lock. Atop the cabinet was a small clay sculpture of Teddy Roosevelt on horseback from the Rough Riders era. A gifted artist, Charlie's mother had made it for Winston years before, and the best parts of the intricate rendering were the detachable pieces fashioned from other media, the aluminum canteen that hung from a strap slung over his shoulder, the wooden replica of a Krag Jorgensen M1896 carbine, and the cloth, wide-brimmed slouch hat. Charlie carefully lifted the hat. The key still sat tucked inside the liner where he had discovered it years earlier. He plucked it out and unlocked the wooden cabinet. Winston Martyr was a man for whom the need for order and the demands upon him were constantly at war, and the messy but alphabetized files bore witness to this struggle. Charlie soon found the NBC section with the red folder containing the This Is Your Life investigation into Strongfellow. He took what he needed, locked the cabinet, returned the key to Teddy's hat, and left his father's study, his heart pounding. In his dreams, he was being shaken, up and down, left and right, taken across bumps and troughs, reminiscent of his ride on a Higgins boat from his battleship through the Chop to Normandy Beach. His mother came into his room shortly after 8 a.m., carrying a tray with buttered wheat toast, scrambled eggs, and coffee. She set the tray on his nightstand and folded her arms with a pointed glance at her wristwatch. There was nothing like a night spent in one's childhood bed to make one feel young again, and not necessarily in a good way. Charlie flung an arm across his eyes and peered out at her from beneath it.
"Your father is expecting you at the club at noon," she said. "He asked me to let you know he's very interested in discussing the farm bill."
"Okay, Mom, thanks."
"He read the bill earlier, took it from your briefcase."
Charlie couldn't tell if she was irritated or proud.
"I told him not to. I said that those papers belonged to a United States congressman and he couldn't just open up your valise as if you were still a child, but he said you wanted to discuss it with him.
She shook her head in a gesture that was both familiar and familiarly inscrutable, and then left, closing the door firmly behind her. Charlie put his arm back down. His bedroom had remained untouched since he left for college in 1938, complete with 1927, 1929, 1932, 1936, 1937, and 1938 World Series champions New York Yankees banners, and a cache of photographs of Hollywood starlets in a folder buried in his bottom desk drawer. His mother would have frozen the room in amber, and Charlie with it if she could have. She clearly preferred him as a boy, cuddly and curious. He felt a pang of nostalgia, not exactly for his youth, but for a time when Babe Ruth's salary demands were his most pressing concern. He swung his feet to the floor, reached beneath the mattress, and groped with mild panic for the This Is Your Life folder on Strongfellow before he found it, extracted it, and prepared to face his day. The Harvard Club of New York was one of Winston Martyr's favorite places on earth, and one of Charlie's least favorite. The power broker made a point of visiting the club on West 44th Street frequently, so as to circulate among other powerful men on the squash court, or at the bar, or while sipping brandy from a snifter in front of a fireplace. He was frequently leaned on by fellow members for favors and deals. He had helped raise money for the recently added Ladies Annex and World War II Memorial at the club, and was currently lobbying for the New York Community Trust to recognize their building as an honorary landmark, though it had been around for only 60 years or so. That Charlie hadn't even applied to Harvard disappointed Winston, though he never admitted it to even his wife. If Charlie wanted to blaze his own path, that was fine, he said, but he knew that also might have meant that Charlie didn't want to end up like him. In the dark mahogany-paneled room where a violinist walked table to table performing Vivaldi, Winston was two sips into his ice-cold martini and one bite into his shrimp cocktail when Charlie appeared and sat down. The waitstaff knew what Winston Martyr expected to have prepared for him when he arrived, always exactly on time. Charlie sat and ordered coffee while he perused the menu. Winston looked up to see his son wearing a shirt and tie he'd taken from his father's closet.
"Nice duds," he said.
"You're the one who picked a place with a dress code." His father chose to ignore this, and dispensing with conversational niceties, he went straight to the point.
"I perused the phone bill in your briefcase, and I thought I might help you decode some of the legislative ease."
"I think I can read a bill, Pop."
"You missed the fine print when it came to the Goodstone earmark, did you not?"
Winston asked, biting into a shrimp. He licked a dollop of cocktail sauce off his thumb.
"Bottom line," Winston continued, "amid the normal subsidies the federal government gives out, the price supports and whatnot, this bill also gives hundreds of millions of dollars to General Kinetics to build new pesticide plants all over the country, essentially however they see fit, with no government supervision."
Charlie's dad squeezed a lemon slice onto his three remaining shrimp, then wolfed down two of them in rapid succession. He gulped the rest of his martini and looked sternly over the tops of his glasses at Charlie. Charlie thought about his father's crude eating habits, which he had always believed betrayed his outer borough roots. In front of more refined company, he displayed more elegant manners, but if it was just family around, even at a restaurant, he returned to the practices of his youth in a modest tenement house where, as the youngest of seven children, he had to grab food and scarf it down, or he would go to bed hungry. Winston peered at his son through his glasses.
"I would co-sponsor it, were I you," he said.
"That wasn't where I thought you were going with this," Charlie said.
"No, because I gave you the bluff, the bottom line up front, the stuff you're going to worry about. Two reasons why you should co-sponsor. Politics and policy. Which do you want first?"
"Politics is fine."
"Jack Kennedy has been making enemies by voting against farm interests. It might stand in the way of his getting the Veep slot in 56. Why not make friends instead? It's not as though anyone in your district gives a crap one way or the other."
"All right," said Charlie. "And policy?" Winston drained the last of his martini.
"Pesticides are not only a huge part of how we feed our own people, they're vital to how we and our allies fight communism. Right now, in Malaya, the Brits are using defoliation to destroy where the communists hide."
"We just voted on a bill to send aid to the Brits for that," he said. The waiter approached the table and asked Charlie's father if he was going to have his usual. Winston nodded. Charlie requested the soup and sandwich of the day.
"What's the downside?"
Winston asked his son.
You make a friend in Chairman Carlin. You get some fundraising from the Heartland. You help farmers. You help defeat the Red Menace abroad.
You're asking me, an army captain who lost a soldier to nerve gas, what can go wrong with chemicals? This is why I pushed to block permitting on the General Kinetics plant in Harlem.
Things can go wrong with any factory. Out in Queens today, a forklift operator will drop a box of Slinkies on his co-worker's head. In Iowa, a farmhand will trip and drown in a feed silo. At a Texas slaughterhouse, a meat cleaver will land in the wrong place. They're all the casualties of progress.
Was Private Rodriguez a casualty of progress? Winston waved his hand at his son's question as if he were swatting away a gnat. A waiter deftly placed a filet mignon in front of him, while a cocktail waitress replaced his martini. Winston took up his fork and steak knife and tucked into his meal.
Charlie,
he said while chewing,
did you ever hear of Martin Cooney?
I don't think so, Charlie said, looking around for his soup and sandwich.
He died a few years ago, considered the father of neonatology.
Okay.
You were born a few weeks premature. I think you know that.
Charlie nodded. His parents had never been comfortable talking about his birth, and he knew few details.
You were tiny and sickly, and your mother was worried about you. The doctors assured us you'd be fine, but a nurse told me about Cooney. He had set up an incubator ward out in Brooklyn. Dozens of premature babies being cared for and watched round the clock. The newest state-of-the-art incubators imported from Europe.
Why from Europe? The waiter placed Charlie's soup and sandwich before him. He started with the chicken noodle.
Europe was decades ahead of the U.S. on premature babies. Believe it or not, here in this country, premature babies were regarded as weaklings, deficient, like miscarriages, an act of God.
Darwinism.
Exactly. Survival of the fittest. But Cooney didn't see it that way. Not only that, he wanted to help babies of all colors and races and religions and stations in life. Poor babies, rich babies, at no charge. I was truly amazed when I went out to see him on Coney Island.
Coney Island?
25 cents a head. Step right up to see the teeny tiny babies in the incubators. A big sign outside said, "All the world loves a baby." In the summer, crowds would line up to gawk at the baby incubator show.
Charlie blinked. Seriously?
Yes. Right next to the bearded lady and Jojo the dog-faced boy. About 20 or so premature babies fighting for their lives. Shrunken, shriveled, pink. Tragic.
I'm not sure of the point of this story, Charlie said. I guess it's thanks for not leaving me at the freak show? Winston chewed a bite of his steak, then washed it down with a gulp of martini.
Actually, we did. Leave you there.
Charlie was shocked. Excuse me?
You stayed there for 9 days,
Winston said, slicing off another bite of filet.
After which Cooney and the staff thought you were fine to go home.
Jesus, Dad, you left me at a freak show?
Charlie, I would have volunteered to stay at the freak show myself, swallowing swords or covering my body with tattoos if I'd thought it would keep you alive. Shame doesn't enter the picture when your baby's life is at stake.
No, I just mean,
good Christ, you are still in a goddamn incubator. You don't see the world as it is, Charlie. So safely ensconced.
You think when I was slogging,
oh, spare me your war stories,
his dad said, stunning him into silence.
I know you were a goddamn patriot, but for some reason you failed to connect the evil you saw there and what the Allies had to do to stamp it out with the same imperatives here. Let me tell you something. When I was working on that trial of that goddamn cannibal, Fish, I saw the kind of evil that exists out there, and what you might not get is that the threat from the communists is just as evil and just as real, and those fighting them need ammunition, and you keep standing in the goddamn way.
He banged on the table, prompting nearby club members to shoot Charlie concerned looks. Charlie looked down at his briefcase where he'd stowed the stolen NBC Strongfellow investigation. He was doing what he had to do, even to his own father's detriment. He was no longer standing in the way. But he knew he could hardly present this line he'd crossed as proof of his understanding.
Ever since you got back from France, you've been in a goddamn academic ivory tower thinking lofty thoughts,
Winston said,
writing about our founding fathers, who certainly knew what protecting this nation actually meant. But you've missed the point of all of it.
Yes, by all means, lecture me about elitism in the private dining room of the Harvard Club, Charlie thought. He took a bite of his chicken salad sandwich. Boy, he said, chewing, that fish trial sounds disturbing. Seriously, psychologically disturbing. Winston Martyr ran his tongue against his molars, seemingly more focused on stray bits of steak stuck between his teeth than his son's concern over the damage done years ago to his psyche. Charlie went straight from the Harvard Club to Pennsylvania Station, hoping to catch the first train back to Washington. He had refrained from drinking with his father, but he went to the club car of the afternoon congressional train and ordered a bourbon, even before the locomotive lurched and jerked and commenced its southward trip. He checked his watch. 2:50 p.m. The lights in the car flickered as they proceeded under the Hudson River, through the North Tunnel, chugging under Weehawken and Union City, emerging from the underworld via the portal in North Bergen. They zoomed through the slums of Secaucus in Jersey City, crossing over the dingy Passaic River for a brief stop at Pennsylvania Station in Newark, then quickly moved off through Elizabeth, Linden, Rahway. The low-income apartments and one-story homes ran together, blurring the entire state into one giant nebulous town you would never want to live in. The club car bartender refreshed Charlie's drink as he stood at the bar, staring out the window. He thought about the This Is Your Life investigation, the irony of his father sneering at him for not following orders with sufficient obedience, when the only reason he was even in New York City was to steal NBC's This Is Your Life investigation from his dad, a testament to his being all too willing to do what he had to do. He thought of the irony of the fact that, though he had been obsessed with correct usage of the term irony as a young man, he had never truly experienced it until today. He thought of the irony of the fact that his father had been the one to drum into his head the proper use of the term, after he had wrongly used it as a synonym for coincidence, and here he was betraying the man who had taught him what it meant. Or was that not in itself ironic? Charlie's head began to ache. He felt weighed down again. There were the issues that seemed minor in the grand scheme of things intellectually, but still felt like bites of his integrity. Stealing the NBC Strongfellow dossier, his failed Goodstone fight, guilt about McLachlan's death, the pending preposterous comic book hearings, handing off the Boschwitz folder, a lifetime's worth of selling out in just 2 months. And then, of course, the young woman, his fears about what he must have done to have caused her death, though there was part of him that still couldn't believe it. He assumed this was a defense mechanism, and that sooner or later he would accept that he was behind the loss of a life, but he wasn't there yet. And underneath it all, there was Margaret, or the absence thereof. Where was Margaret? God, how he needed her now. Chapter 19. Wednesday, March 10th, 1954. Nanticoke Island, Maryland. From Charlie's enlistment in 1942 until the end of the war, Margaret had tracked his journey on a map she tacked up next to her bed. Starting in Fort Meade, Maryland, pins were placed on the North Carolina-South Carolina border where Charlie next was shipped for practice maneuvers, then to Fort Benning in Georgia. In October 1942, Charlie and the 175th Infantry Regiment crammed into the ocean liner RMS Queen Elizabeth and set sail for England, where they were ultimately given temporary quarters at a former British military base, Tidworth Barracks. She wrote to him every day. He wrote back as often as he could, although that became increasingly difficult as K Company got closer to the front lines. In his letters, Charlie described Tidworth Barracks as ascetic, just a dozen brick buildings with no central heat, each named for a battle the British had fought in India. The barracks had coal-burning fireplaces at each end, but Charlie's bunk stood in the middle, so very little heat reached him throughout that cold, wet English winter. Charlie deployed his usual comic detachment when he wrote to her, but Margaret thought the barracks and the daily training routine sounded miserable. The UK was being bombed constantly, so every night blackout conditions were in effect. Any rare moments of R&R were spent struggling with directions to a restaurant or pub without benefit of street or route signs, which the British had removed in case of enemy invasion. Charlie and his fellow troops conducted practice amphibious assaults on local lakes, rivers, and moors until K Company and the larger infantry regiment were transported to Devon to wait to board the tank landing ships in which they would be shuttled to the beaches of Normandy. Of everything we've experienced here in England, Charlie wrote while waiting to ship out for France in a rare moment of candor, it wasn't the bone-chilling cold of the desperate English winter that made me most miserable, though there was one night where I gladly would have traded a limb for a bucket of coal. And it wasn't the constant threat of air assault, marked by sirens, panic, confusion, and impotence. It was the moors, the dark, dank, foul, freezing, fetid swamps, filled with bacteria and leeches and swarming with mosquitoes, 100 pounds of gear strapped on our backs, pushing us down into the muck, while the slough tricked us with false floors, causing us to stumble and drink in the grime. The experience was akin to dunking my body into a pool of death. That's the only way I can think of to describe it. I cannot say anything more about what we are doing next, but I am sure it will be worse. I don't know if our times in the marshlands prepared us tactically or just barely introduced us to a taste of the horror that awaits on the mainland. Now, 10 years later, standing on her tiptoes on a sandbar in the Atlantic Ocean, saltwater waves splashing into her nose and down her throat, Margaret had some understanding of what Charlie had described. The previous night, Margaret had made a glorious discovery. Quadrani and Hinman, their counterparts on Susquehannock Island, had found the three ponies that had swum to their island and concluded they were a stallion, mare, and foal. A family. On walkie-talkies, they shared what they'd learned. Gwinnett assigned each of the members of his team night shifts in which they were to surreptitiously watch the sleeping strings to see if any made their way to the beach and then the ocean. They did that for 3 nights straight with no results, but then Margaret found a string in a field and patiently waited behind a shrub thicket of marsh elder. Within an hour, just after midnight, she watched a mare lead her family down a narrow path toward the beach. Margaret, crouched over and scurrying quietly behind them, watched as they galloped into the shallows of the surf and onto an apparent sandbar, after which the stallion, mare, and two foals swam out across the bay, the stallion now taking the lead. She raced back to wake up her colleagues and share with them the confirmation of what was something of a revelation in their field, that the ponies, quite unusually, apparently traveled in families, not larger strings, and that the mare, at least in this case, was the driving force to get the family to the water. Tonight, however, as they watched a new string make the journey, it seemed the foal might prove too weak. A strong wind raised a more pugilistic surf than normal, with trains of swell waves hitting shore. As the stallion and mare boldly galloped into the surf, the foal stumbled, her legs wobbly and spindly. "She looks off," said Kessler, kneeling in a patch of beech heather behind a dune where the group had been sitting since dusk.
"Maybe she was premature, or just a runt," Cornelius speculated.
The foal made her way to the sandbar, which was within a few dozen feet of shore, the wave slapping into her flank as she followed her parents.
"Is she going to be able to handle the swimming part of this?" Gwinnett asked. "I think I saw her 2 days ago struggling to keep up just on land."
Aiming Kessler's powerful flashlight at the sandbar, Margaret watched the foal stumble and fall behind while her parents set out into the water. Margaret had long been interested in the bond between mares and foals and whether it had an impact on the larger string, but right now her intense focus was less academic in nature. She realized that at some point the foal would need to begin swimming, and she didn't know if the young pony was up to the task. The foal looked weak but determined, faltering and nearly collapsing before taking a few halting steps, falling farther behind her parents. Margaret held her breath, wondering whether the stallion, or more likely the mare, would opt for nurturing heroism, or if more Darwinian impulses would decide the foal's fate.
"Jesus," Margaret said as a wave smacked the foal's shoulder and half-submerged her head in the water.
"Maybe best not to watch, Margaret," Gwinnett said, placing his hand on her arm.
She twitched instinctively and his hand fell back to his side. The foal, now 10 or so yards behind her galloping parents, continued on her path to Susquehannock Island, but her struggle seemed to increase with each step. She slowed as she waded into deeper water and she began to disappear. The farther and deeper she went, the harder it was for the team to track her progress. Margaret snatched the flashlight from Kessler and ran down the beach, trying to get a better view of the foal.
"Margaret, what are you doing?" Gwinnett shouted from behind her.
The slight extra weight in her midsection slowed Margaret a tad as she began sprinting down the beach, trying to catch up with the foal, running parallel to the angular path of the sandbar and into the surf, lifting her knees to avoid being slowed by the breakers.
"Margaret!" shouted Gwinnett. "Margaret!"
But Margaret barely heard him. She was focused on the young pony, who was trying to keep her head above the waves, fighting not to be dragged down. Margaret waded in and then threw the flashlight onto the sand and dived into the water. She had the foal in her line of sight, maybe 20 feet away, still vaguely illuminated by the moon. The water was shockingly cold. Gwinnett, Kessler, and Cornelius began running down the beach, following Margaret's general direction in the water, but remaining on land. Margaret was maybe 10 feet away from the foal, whose ears were all that were visible as the rip current dragged her from the shore. As a wave approached, Margaret inhaled deeply, then dived into the sea, extending her arms as far forward as possible until finally her fingertips, then her full palms, touched the pony, covered in soft, silky hair. She slid her arms around the sides of the foal's body, clasped her fingers under her barrel, and tried to stand. As she straightened her legs, the depth of the water surprised her. She was able to stand, but barely, on the balls of her feet, with her head and mouth just reaching the air above. She found herself trapped in a tug-of-war with the undertow, as she and the foal battled against the current. It was then that she thought, for just a split second, of Charlie and his stories from training for D-Day. She could hear the men yelling from the shore, but she didn't know what they were saying, and she didn't care. The foal couldn't have weighed that much, and given natural buoyancy, Margaret thought she should have been able to quickly float the pony to the shallows. But it proved more difficult than she'd anticipated. The foal's thrashing complicated her attempts to hang on to her as the ocean dragged her out to sea. Soon Margaret could no longer touch the bottom of the ocean. She was athletic enough to keep holding the foal's head above the water, the scissor kick of her legs preventing them from drifting farther. But the result was essentially stasis. Then, suddenly, the burden of the foal was partly lifted, and the mass of their bodies was successfully resisting the undertow. Though the inky black sky and dark ocean had all but merged into one ominous void for Margaret, she could sense that someone else had joined them. At first, in her panic, she imagined some giant fish or dolphin, some magical sea creature arriving, deus ex machina. But after she regained her footing, and she and the foal edged their way to a shallower patch where she could stand, she saw that it was a man with them, and he had the foal by her head and forelegs and was helping to carry her while also bringing both of them to safety. And she thought, maybe it was Gwinnett, but then the man raised his head to look at her, and she was stunned to see that it was Charlie. Chapter 20, Wednesday, March 10th, 1954, Maryland Rural Route 32. His sudden trip to Nanticoke Island had been the most impulsive action Charlie had taken in a decade. Behaving erratically energized and emboldened him, allowing him to cast off the chains of predictable adult behavior amid the chaotic swirl of his life these past 3 months. He had gotten off the train in Baltimore and hired a taxi to take him to the end of Maryland Rural Route 32, the tip of the isthmus, although he had to try 8 different cabbies before he finally found one who agreed to do it, for twice the normal rate. Charlie had the cash on hand. Part of him must have known he was going to make this rash journey. He told the hack he'd give him $50 if he waited an hour in that same spot. He arrived at the tip of the isthmus just after 8 p.m. There was a narrow footbridge from there to Susquehannock Island, but to get to Nanticoke he would need a boat. The local live bait store was not yet open for the season, but a young man doing inventory on new rods and reels, nets and lures, agreed to rent him a motorboat. He took it to Nanticoke Island and disembarked at the small, shabby dock. From there, Charlie had walked through a thicket of trees, then to the campsite, which cast the only light he could discern on the island, from a still crackling fire around which stood 4 tents. No one was there, but he heard noises from beyond some bushes, past a dune, so he headed to what he presumed would be the beach. From the dune, he saw Margaret in the distance running into the water. He wasn't sure why. He watched in disbelief as the 3 men made their way to the closest spot to her on the sand, but never went into the water. Charlie began running toward his wife and saw her head disappear beneath the waves. Next thing Charlie knew, he was sprinting into the sea, gasping at its frigidity, racing toward Margaret, and what he now saw was a thrashing pony. He grabbed the pony around her barrel behind her front legs and eased her and Margaret to shallower water until the 2 of them were together, carrying the pony to the safety of the sand. Margaret and Charlie locked eyes and gently laid the foal on the beach away from the waves before they collapsed on hands and knees, gasping for breath and shivering in the cold. At last the other men sprang into action.
Cornelius tended to the foal, covering her with a towel while he checked her pulse and breathing. Kessler draped blankets over Charlie's and Margaret's shoulders, while Gwinnett checked their pulses. Margaret, in an adrenaline-fueled daze, kept looking at Charlie and shaking her head. Whether in disbelief that he was really here, or that they had just pulled off this unlikely rescue, he couldn't tell. After a few more minutes of silence, Margaret stood and approached Cornelius, still ministering to the wet foal. The pony lay on her side with her head in the grad student's lap. He was scratching her chin groove with one hand, patting her muzzle with the other. She had a teardrop-shaped pattern on her forehead, recalling the stallion from weeks before. Her flank was expanding and contracting at a rapid clip, her eyes staring dolefully at nothing in particular until they flickered to Margaret. Against all her scientific training and instincts, Margaret felt a connection, almost an understanding passed between them.
"She's going to be okay, I think," Cornelius said.
"Well, she's going to live," Margaret said, "but I don't know that she's going to survive without her parents. Maybe we can get her to a local farm."
"Why don't we go to the camp?" Gwinnett suggested. "Warm up by the fire."
Charlie put a tentative arm around Margaret's shoulders, and the two headed to the warmth of the fire that Kessler was now feeding with kindling. It was agreed that Margaret and Charlie should get out of their wet clothes, so Margaret went into her tent, and Charlie accepted Gwinnett's offer of a loan to replace his soaking wet pants, shirt, and socks. The group stood around the fire warming themselves, and finally Charlie spoke. "With Margaret's permission, I'd like to take her home. She can come back after a little rest, I think. Yes?" He turned to Margaret, and she nodded.
"You sure about that, Mags?"
Gwinnett asked. She nodded again. Charlie shook Gwinnett's hand with a firm grip and looked him in the eye. The message was clear, he felt. "I've got it from here, fella."
"Okay, we can leave your camp set up," Gwinnett said. "We'll be here till the first week of May. Come back as soon as you can."
"We can move your tent and gear to Susquehannock in 2 weeks," Kessler added, "or bring it to you in D.C. in a month." The martyrs walked through the brush into the dock. Charlie guided Margaret into the motorboat he had rented, and they headed to the mainland where the cabbie was waiting. They were spent, so they asked him to take them to the local motel, Polly's Lodging. The two barely spoke as they were driven through the dark, though Charlie's hand eventually found its way to Margaret's. Margaret recognized Polly from her last visit to the island in January when she'd borrowed the motel phone, but the woman gave no sign of remembering her. She informed Charlie that they had plenty of rooms and offered them what she referred to without a trace of sarcasm as the honeymoon suite, at no extra charge, if they indeed would be staying only one night. He looked at Margaret, who squeezed his hand. With his briefcase and her leather satchel between them, they walked to room 20, and Charlie locked the door behind them. The clock by their bedside said 1:05.
"Well," said Margaret, sitting on the bed and exhaling loudly, "that was something."
Charlie pulled up a chair and tried to think of what to say.
"I've really missed you," he finally blurted out. "I'm right here."
"Are you?" She sniffed, still cold from the ocean, and reached for a tissue.
"Yes," she said. "We haven't talked in forever."
Margaret pulled an elastic band from around her wrist and put her blonde hair up in a ponytail.
"Truth train?"
Charlie smiled. His parents' wedding present to them had been a round-trip train ride on the most famous train in the world, the 20th Century Limited, from New York's Grand Central Terminal to Chicago's LaSalle Street Station, a trip they took in the summer of 1947. It was not the easiest time in their marriage, as Charlie was struggling with war memories and what seemed to him a shallow and silly civilian world. After a couple of cocktails one evening, Margaret came up with the idea that while they were on the train, they could speak only the 100% truth to each other. The result was shockingly effective. The truths one revealed and explored were usually about one's own bad behavior. And for the next year or so, they would use the term truth train to temporarily reinstate those rules. It had been at least 5 years since either had invoked it.
"Truth train," Charlie agreed.
"We haven't talked in forever because I've made it clear I didn't like what you had to say."
Charlie grimaced. She was so much better at truth train than he was. "I know," he acknowledged. She sat waiting for him to offer a contribution. Finally, he told her, "I've been doing the best I can. This hasn't been easy. You and the baby. Everything is so new, and Washington is such a messed up place." He heard weakness in his voice and cursed himself for it,
He wanted to be honest, but he didn't want her to think he couldn't handle the pressures of their new life. Margaret's face was stony, unreadable. She leaned back on the bed.
I'm assuming there's much more going on here than those insipid comic book hearings. And part of me doesn't want to know more. But that's selfish.
Her face softened. I think I've been afraid to find out more. You don't want to hear that I'm not the man you thought you'd married. Charlie took her hands in his. I didn't think you did. He looked down at the floor and shook his head. It was hard to meet her gaze knowing everything he had to tell her. Margaret squeezed his hand sympathetically.
You sound just a bit self-pitying there, honey.
He winced, then smiled. I forgot how turbulent the truth train can be.
I want to help, but I have to know what's going on.
That's why I came here. I can get through this, but not without you. He was surprised to see her eyes glistening with tears. She patted the bed next to her. He obligingly crawled onto it and sank against the pillows. Margaret propped herself up on an elbow and turned to him, all trace of emotion replaced by her usual inquisitive and methodical manner.
All right, darling. I want to hear everything.
So he told her. Hands clasped behind his head, Charlie found it easier to look at the motel ceiling than at Margaret as he unburdened himself. He began at the beginning, why he had the congressional seat. Congressman Van Wagenen's death might not have been as neat and tidy as it seemed, at least not according to Congressman Christian McLachlan, who was now also dead, shot by Puerto Rican terrorists.
What was Max suggesting happened to Van Wagenen? She asked.
Nothing specific, just vague allusions to how nothing was what it seemed, how Van Wagenen had kept up the fight against companies cutting corners.
I thought Van Wagenen committed suicide.
Me too, but Street says he was found in a hotel with a prostitute. They were both dead. Margaret's face settled into an expression of confused disbelief as Charlie told her about the odd note he found in the desk that was once Van Wagenen's. U Chicago, 2, 4D, 2, 4, 5T, cereal grains, broadleaf crops. You remember my perky intern, Cheryl Ann Bernstein? She came to the house that time? Margaret nodded with a slight roll of her eyes. Her brother's at Northwestern, so she asked him to go see what that meant, but he hit a dead end. A woman at the University of Chicago said the study was subject to wartime secrecy laws.
War's been over for a decade, Margaret observed.
Yes, so I've read, Charlie said. Strongfellow's on House Armed Services, so he explored it at the Pentagon, but also didn't get anywhere. She wrinkled her brow.
This is all just so bizarre.
It gets stranger, because now Mac is dead, Charlie said, and on his deathbed, the last thing he said to me was, under Jennifer. She scrunched up her face in confusion, and Charlie nodded. We had no idea who Jennifer was, but then Cheryl Ann came up with a smart theory. He started telling her about Maryland delegate Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, but Margaret held up her hand to stop him.
I need to write all this down, she said.
She opened the drawer of the nightstand and withdrew a pad of paper and a sharpened pencil. Mac, she wrote at the top of the pad, followed by other reminders of related threads. This was how they worked together while he was writing Sons of Liberty. He would research and share his discoveries, and then she would take notes and categorize every item until they could come up with coherent narratives.
Congressman Street and this girl, Cheryl Ann, how much do they know about your predicament? Margaret asked.
Cheryl Ann knows a little about the broadleaf crops known and about Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, obviously, Charlie said. Isaiah knows everything.
Okay, what else? She asked. Whatever happened with your main mission, to stop funding for Goodstone?
Charlie shook his head. I thought I'd achieved it. Carlin told me it was out of the bill. We voted. Everyone was patting me on the back.
Did you read the bill? She interrupted.
I did, he said. There were no references to Goodstone. That section had been deleted. But then, well, Conrad Hilton was throwing a party, a celebration of the migrant bill passing, so we were all at the penthouse of the Mayflower, and Carlin was there. The night got away from me a bit. Strongfellow and Bob Kennedy were there. Roy Cohn, too. We got into it about Ike and patriotism, and I got hit with the Cohn crazy spray. But more to the point, eventually I ended up drinking absinthe with Carlin, Strongfellow, and some others. La Montaigne.
Oh.
Margaret tapped the pencil against her cheek, thoughtfully.
This must have been the morning you came home reeking like a distillery rag.
Correct.
Boy, I hated you that morning.
Charlie remained silent, knowing she had every right to resent him, and he hadn't even gotten to the worst of it yet. The car accident. He told her about Carlin cackling when he said, "I screwed you on Goodstone," and, to be fair, because he was nothing if not diligently so, about Carlin's argument that businesses such as Goodstone and General Kinetics needed to thrive as much for national security as for national economic advancement.
"It's so odd that he told you about it," Margaret said. "Why not just do it and go on about his life?"
"Clearly he doesn't like me," said Charlie, who had given the matter some serious thought. "He didn't appreciate my original protest of the funding. And look, he's a hard-scrabble, pull-himself-up-by-his-own-bootstraps kind of guy from Snake Skull, Oklahoma, and to him I must seem like an entitled establishment New Yorker who breezed into Congress without any right to be there." Margaret kept writing. Underneath Carlin, she added a note about the chairman's request that Charlie co-sponsor the farm bill with him.
"This is all about controlling you," Margaret observed,
and it was difficult to argue with that, though Charlie told her that when he'd asked Carlin to block the General Kinetics plant from Harlem, Carlin had said he would.
"Carlin screwed you on Goodstone because it would hurt General Kinetics," Margaret noted. "Do you assume he's going to follow through with the Harlem plant?"
"I don't know. Maybe now that he thinks I'm playing ball?" It was after 2 o'clock in the morning, but neither wanted to stop talking, and the work was almost beside the point. On a page Margaret labeled miscellaneous, a list of names and events grew long. Carlin, Strongfellow, Cohn, Kennedy, Kefauver, Poker Night, Comic Book Hearing. She designated the next page odd, and that list included Margaret Chase Smith's suggestion that Charlie use the special members-only collection at the Library of Congress to do more research on Ben Franklin and the Hellfire Club.
"Why do you think she made such a point of recommending that?"
And although Charlie wasn't sure if or how it related to his ongoing troubles, she insisted on adding his father's drunken luncheon lecture and the unsettling revelation about the Coney Island incubators. She came to the end of the page and looked at him expectantly.
"There's more, isn't there?"
That she knew him so well was both perilous and the whole point. Charlie nodded grimly and took a deep breath. "So LaMontagne gave me a file full of dirt against a guy at Zenith, Ira Boschwitz, a competitor, about him being a commie. I went back and forth on it, but ultimately I did what LaMontagne told me to and gave it to Bob Kennedy for the McCarthy Committee. I saw in the paper 3 days later that he'd been called before the committee and that he'd been fired." She sat silently for a minute, her head tilted to one side. Were all these compromised decisions just part of adulthood? She knew of no such corruption of her martyred father, but was that only because she didn't really know about his life, or because he had been killed so young? Now that she thought about it, was his participation in that mission without blemish? The captain of the USS Shenandoah had seen that thunderstorms would be on the flight path and urged command to wait them out. He'd been overruled, and 14 men, including her dad, had been killed. Surely they had all known of the bad weather, yet they went along with their orders. Was that so dissimilar from the difficult orders Charlie faced?
"I could see that decision not being so simple," she finally allowed. "I mean, what if he ends up being a communist, and it comes out that you sat on the file? It would be easy for me to judge. But who knows if it's wrong or right? It's not as if there aren't communists infiltrating the world of defense contractors."
Charlie nodded slowly. "Yeah, that's how I rationalized it, but it wasn't a proud moment, and I don't trust LaMontagne." Margaret was less understanding when he told her about McCarthy asking him to steal the file on NBC's investigation into Strongfellow from his father's study.
"Why on earth would you do that?" she asked.
And that was when he had to tell her the worst of it, the car accident. He didn't know who knew what, and he was terrified to disobey anyone, lest that person ruin his life. As calmly and clearly as he knew how, Charlie recounted the events of that awful night, those he remembered at any rate. He watched his wife's face closely as she tried to understand what he was telling her. Waking up in the mud, LaMontagne's arrival, the discovery of the dead woman, LaMontagne carrying her corpse to the car, Charlie refusing to take part in it, but also refusing to stop it, the two of them driving off, how he'd collapsed later that morning from the guilt of it all, his terror that he might have killed an innocent woman. When he was finally done, the tiny room was silent. Outside, a chorus of crickets chirped. Margaret looked at her husband with an expression that suggested both shock and revulsion, and then, without a word, she stood up from the bed, walked to the door, opened it, and took in great gulps of fresh air. The cricket's refrain grew louder and seemed almost taunting to Charlie. He sat helpless while she stood ramrod straight in the doorway, her arms folded across her chest, her chin thrust out defiantly. He feared he had lost her, that this had been a bridge too far. Had telling her been a selfish decision? Had he blown up his marriage in the name of saving it? Charlie didn't know what to say. His heart pounded with desperation.